10,000 eternal years. That's enough time to watch all of human history unfold, from the invention of writing to the present, with each day lasting as long as it takes for the bird to wear down a mountain. While 140 characters may not seem like a lot, we will never run out of things to say. Chapter 42, Lego Bridge. Question. How many Lego bricks would it take to build a bridge capable of carrying traffic from London to New York? Have that many Lego bricks been manufactured? Jerry Peterson. Answer. Let's start with a less ambitious goal. Making the connection. There have certainly been enough Lego bricks to connect New York and London. In Lego units, New York and London are 700 million studs apart. That means that if you started laying out a chain of overlapping bricks, it would take 350 million of them to connect the two cities. The bridge wouldn't be able to hold itself together, or carry anything bigger than a Lego minifig, but it's a start. There have been over 400 billion Lego pieces produced over the years. But how many of those are bricks that would help with a bridge? And how many are little helmet visors that get lost in the carpet? Let's assume we're building our bridge out of the most common Lego piece, the 2x4 brick. Using data provided by Dan Boger, Lego kit archivist and operator of the Piron.com Lego data site, I've come up with the following rough estimate. One out of every 50 to 100 pieces is a 2x4 rectangular brick. This suggests that there are about 5 to 10 billion 2x4 bricks in existence, which is more than enough for our one-block-wide bridge. Supporting cars. Of course, if we want to support actual traffic, we'll need to make the bridge a little wider. We probably want to make the bridge float. The Atlantic Ocean is deep, citation needed, and we want to avoid building 3-mile-high pylons out of Lego bricks if we can. Lego bricks don't make a watertight seal when you connect them together. Citation, I made a Lego boat once and put it in the water, and it sank. And the plastic used to make them is denser than water. That's easy enough to solve. If we put a layer of sealant over the outer surface, the resulting block is substantially less dense than water. For every cubic meter of water it displaces, the bridge can carry 400 kilograms. A typical passenger car weighs a little under 2,000 kilograms, so our bridge will need a minimum of 10 cubic meters of Lego supporting each passenger car. If we make the bridge a meter thick and 5 meters wide, then it should be able to stay afloat without any trouble, although it might ride low in the water and be sturdy enough to drive on. Legos are quite strong. According to a BBC investigation, you could stack a quarter of a million 2x2 bricks on top of each other before the bottom one collapsed. Maybe it was a slow news day. The first problem with this idea is that there aren't nearly enough Lego blocks in the world to build this kind of bridge. Our second problem is the ocean. Extreme forces. The North Atlantic is a stormy place. While our bridge would manage to avoid the fastest moving parts of the Gulf Stream current, it would still be subjected to powerful wind and wave forces. How strong could we make our bridge? Thanks to a researcher at the University of Southern Queensland named Tristan Lostro, we have some data on the tensile strength of certain Lego joints. Their conclusion, like the BBC's, is that Lego bricks are surprisingly tough. The optimal design would use long, thin plates overlapped with each other. This design would be pretty strong. The tensile strength would be comparable to concrete, but not nearly strong enough. The wind, waves, and current would push the center of the bridge sideways, creating tremendous tension in the bridge. The traditional way to deal with this situation would be to anchor the bridge to the ground so it can't drift too far to one side. If we allow ourselves to use cables in addition to the Lego bricks and sealant, we could conceivably tether this massive contraption to the seafloor. If we wanted to try to use Lego pieces, we could get kits that include little nylon ropes. But the problems don't end there. A 5-meter bridge might be able to support a vehicle on a placid pond, but our bridge needs to be large enough to stay above water when waves are breaking over it. Typical wave heights on the open ocean could be several meters. so we need the deck of our bridge to be floating at least, say, 4 meters above the water. We can make our structure more buoyant by adding air sacs and hollows, but we also need to make it wider, otherwise it will tip over. This means we have to add more anchors with floats on those anchors to keep them from sinking. The floats create more drag, which puts more stress on the cables and pushes our structure downward, requiring more floats on the structure. Wait, this is just the pylon idea again. Seafloor. If we want to build our bridge down to the sea floor, we'll have a few problems. We wouldn't be able to keep the air sacs open under the pressure, so the structure would have to support its own weight. To handle the pressure from the ocean currents, we'd have to make it wider. In the end, we'd effectively be building a causeway. As a side effect, our bridge would halt the North Atlantic Ocean circulation. According to climate scientists, this is, quote, probably bad. They went on to say, wait, what did you say you were trying to build? And how did you get in here anyway? Furthermore, the bridge would cross the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. The Atlantic seafloor is spreading outward from a seam down the middle at a rate, in Lego units, of one stud every 112 days. We would have to build in expansion joints or drive out to the middle every so often and add a bunch of bricks. Cost. Lego bricks are made of ABS plastic, which costs about $1 per kilogram at the time of this writing. Even our simplest bridge design, the one with the kilometer-long steel tethers, my favorite Friends episode, would cost over $5 trillion. But consider, the total value of the London real estate market is $2.1 trillion, and transatlantic shipping rates are about $30 per ton. This means that for less than the cost of our bridge, we could buy all the property in London and ship it piece by piece to New York. Then we could reassemble it on a new island in New York Harbor and connect the two cities with a much simpler Lego bridge. We might even have enough left over to buy that sweet Millennium Falcon kit. Chapter 43, Longest Sunset. Question. What is the longest possible sunset you can experience while driving, assuming we are obeying the speed limit and driving on paved roads? Michael Berg. Answer. To answer this, we have to be sure what we mean by sunset. Sunset starts the instant the sun touches the horizon and ends when it disappears completely. If the sun touches the horizon and then lifts back up, the sunset is disqualified. For a sunset to count, the sun has to set behind the idealized horizon, not just behind a nearby hill. The reason it can't count as a sunset is that if you could use arbitrary obstacles, you could cause a sunset at any time by hiding behind a rock. We also have to consider refraction. The Earth's atmosphere bends light, so when the sun is at the horizon, it appears about one sun width higher than it would otherwise. The standard practice seems to be to include the average effect of this in all calculations, which I've done here. At the equator in March and September, sunset is a hair over 2 minutes long. Closer to the poles, in places like London, it can take between 200 and 300 seconds. It's shortest in spring and fall, when the sun is over the equator, and longest in the summer and winter. If you stand still at the South Pole in early March, the sun stays in the sky all day, making a full circle just above the horizon. Sometime around March 21st, it touches the horizon for the only sunset of the year. This sunset takes 38 to 40 hours, which means it makes more than a full circuit around the horizon while setting. But Michael's question was very clear. He asked about the longest sunset you can experience on a paved road. There's a road to the research station at the South Pole, but it's not paved. It's made of packed snow. There are no paved roads anywhere near either pole. The closest road to either pole that really qualifies as paved is probably the main road in Longyearbyen on the island of Svalbard, Norway. The end of the airport runway in Longyearbyen gets you slightly closer to the pole, although driving a car there might get you in trouble. Longyearbyen is actually closer to the North Pole than McMurdo Station in Antarctica is to the South Pole. There are a handful of military research and fishing stations farther north, but none of them have much in the way of roads, just airstrips, which are usually gravel and snow. If you putter around downtown Longyearbyen, get a picture with the polar bear crossing sign. The longest sunset you could experience would be a few minutes short of an hour. It doesn't actually matter if you drive or not. The town is too small for your movement to make a difference. But if you head over to the mainland, where the roads are longer, you can do even better. If you start driving from the tropics and stay on paved roads, the farthest north you can get is the tip of European Route 69 in Norway. There are a number of roads crisscrossing northern Scandinavia, so that seems like a good place to start. But which road should we use? Intuitively, it seems like we want to be as far north as possible. The closer we are to the pole, the easier it is to keep up with the sun. Unfortunately, it turns out keeping up with the sun isn't a good strategy. Even in those high Norwegian latitudes, the sun is just too fast. At the tip of European Route 69, the farthest you can get from the equator while driving on paved roads, you'd still have to drive at about half the speed of sound to keep up with the sun. And E69 runs north-south, not east-west, so you'd drive into the Barents Sea anyway. Luckily, there's a better approach. If you were looking down at a city in Norway on a day when the sun came very close to setting, the Terminator, or day-night line, would advance up from the lower right, just barely touch the south edge of the city, and then fall away to the lower left. This is in contrast to the capital T Terminator, which always moves directly towards Sarah Connor. I can't decide which Terminator I'd rather have to run from. To get a long sunset, the strategy is simple. Wait for the date when the Terminator will just barely reach your position. Sit in your car until the Terminator reaches you, drive north to stay a little ahead of it for as long as you can, depending on the local road layout, then U-turn and drive back south fast enough that you can get past it to the safety of darkness. These instructions also work for the other kind of Terminator. Surprisingly, this strategy works about equally well anywhere inside the Arctic Circle, so you can get this lengthy sunset on many roads across Finland and Norway. I ran a search for long sunset driving paths using PiFM and some GPS traces of Norwegian highways. I found that over a wide range of routes and driving speeds, the longest sunset was consistently about 95 minutes, an improvement of about 40 minutes over the Svalbard sit-in-one-place strategy. But if you are stuck in Svalbard and want to make the sunset, or sunrise, last a little longer, you can always try spinning counterclockwise. See XKCD Angular Momentum, xkcd.com/162. It's true that it will add only an immeasurably small fraction of a nanosecond to the Earth's clock, but depending on who you're with, it might be worth it. Chapter 44, Random Sneeze Call. Question. If you call a random phone number and say God bless you, what are the chances that the person who answers just sneezed, Mimi? Answer. It's hard to find good numbers on this, but it's probably about 1 in 40,000. Before you pick up the phone, you should also keep in mind that there's roughly a 1 in 1 billion chance that the person you're calling just murdered someone, based on a rate of 4 per 100,000, which is the average in the U.S., but on the high end for industrialized countries. You may want to be more careful with your blessings. However, given that sneezes are far more common than murders, citation, you are alive, you're still much more likely to get someone who sneezed than to catch a killer. So this strategy is not recommended. Compared with the murder rate, the sneezing rate doesn't get much scholarly research. The most widely cited figure for average sneeze frequency comes from a doctor interviewed by ABC News, who pegged it at 200 sneezes per person per year. One of the few scholarly sources of data on sneezing is a study that monitored the sneezing of people undergoing an induced allergic reaction. To estimate the average sneezing rate, we can ignore all the real medical data they were trying to gather and just look at their control group. This group was given no allergens at all. They just sat alone in a room for a total of 176 20-minute sessions. For context, that's 490 repetitions of the song Hey Jude. The subjects in the control group sneezed four times during those 58 or so hours. Over 58 hours of research, 4 sneezes were the most interesting data points. I might have taken the 490 Hey Judes. Which, assuming they sneeze only while awake, translates to about 400 sneezes per person per year. Google Scholar turns up 5,980 articles from 2012 that mention sneezing. If half of these articles are from the U.S., and each one has an average of 4 authors, then if you dial the number, there's about a 1 in 10 million chance that you'll get someone who just that day published an article on sneezing. On the other hand, about 60 people are killed by lightning in the U.S. every year. That means there's only a 1 in 10 trillion chance that you'll call someone in the 30 seconds after they've been struck and killed. Lastly, let's suppose that on the day this book was published, 5 people who read it decide to actually try this experiment. If they call numbers all day, there's about a 1 in 30,000 chance that at some point during the day, one of them will get a busy signal, because the person they've called is also calling a random stranger to say God bless you. And there's about a 1 in 10 trillion chance that 2 of them will simultaneously call each other. At this point, probability will give up, and they'll both be struck by lightning. Weird and worrying questions from the What If inbox, number 10. Question. What is the probability that if I am stabbed by a knife in my torso that it won't hit anything vital and I'll live? Thomas. Answer. Asking for a friend. Former friend, I mean. Question. If I were on a motorbike and do a jump off a quarter pipe ramp, how fast would I need to be moving to safely deploy and land using the parachute? Anonymous. Question. What if every day every human had a 1% chance of being turned into a turkey, and every turkey had a 1% chance of being turned into a human? Kenneth. Chapter 45, Expanding Earth. Question. How long would it take for people to notice their weight gain if the mean radius of the world expanded by 1 centimeter every second, assuming the average composition of rock were maintained? Dennis O'Donnell. Answer. The Earth is not currently expanding. People have long suggested that it might be. Before the continental drift hypothesis was confirmed in the 1960s, people had noticed that the continents fit together. The smoking gun that confirmed the theory of plate tectonics was the discovery of seafloor spreading. The way seafloor spreading and magnetic pole reversal neatly confirmed each other is one of my favorite examples of scientific discovery at work. Various ideas were put forward to explain this, including the idea that the ocean basins were rifts that opened in the surface of a previously smooth Earth as it expanded. This theory was never very widespread. It turns out it's kind of dumb, although it still periodically makes the rounds on YouTube. To avoid the problem of rifts in the ground, let's imagine all the matter in the Earth, from the crust to the core, starts expanding uniformly. To avoid another drain the ocean scenario, we'll assume the ocean expands too. As it turns out, the ocean is expanding, since it's getting warmer. This is, currently, the main way global warming is raising the sea level. All human structures will stay. T equals 1 second. It's a small world, not for long. As the Earth started expanding, you'd feel a slight jolt, and might even lose your balance for a moment. This would be very brief. Since you're moving steadily upward at 1 centimeter per second, you wouldn't feel any kind of ongoing acceleration. For the rest of the day, you wouldn't notice much of anything. T equals 1 day. After the first day, the Earth would have expanded by 864 meters. Gravity would take a long time to increase noticeably. If you weighed 70 kilograms when the expansion started, you'd weigh 70.01 at the end of the first day. What about our roads and bridges? Eventually, they would have to break up, right? Not as quickly as you might think. Here's a puzzle I once heard. Imagine you tied a rope tightly around the Earth so it was hugging the surface all the way around. Now, imagine you wanted to raise the rope 1 meter off the ground. How much extra length will you need to add to the rope? Though it may seem like you'd need miles of rope, the answer is 6.28 meters. Circumference is proportional to radius. So if you increase radius by 1 unit, you increase circumference by 2 pi units. Stretching a 40,000-kilometer line an extra 6.28 meters is pretty negligible. Even after a day, the extra 5.4 kilometers would be handled easily by virtually all structures. Concrete expands and contracts by more than that every day. After the initial jolt, one of the first effects you'd notice would be that your GPS would stop working. The satellites would stay in roughly the same orbits, but the delicate timing that the GPS system is based on would be completely ruined within hours. GPS timing is incredibly precise. Of all the problems in engineering, it's one of the only ones in which engineers have been forced to include both special and general relativity in their calculations. Most other clocks would keep working fine. However, if you have a very precise pendulum clock, you might notice something odd. By the end of the day, it would be 3 seconds ahead of where it should be. T equals 1 month. After a month, the Earth would have expanded by 26 kilometers, an increase of 0.4%, and its mass would have increased by 1.2%. Surface gravity would have gone up by only 0.4% rather than 1.2%, since surface gravity is proportional to radius. Mass is proportional to radius cubed, and gravity is proportional to mass times inverse square of radius, so radius cubed divided by radius squared equals radius. You might notice the difference in weight on a scale, but it's not a big deal. Gravity varies by this much between different cities already. This is a good thing to keep in mind if you buy a digital scale. If your scale has a precision of more than 2 decimal places, you need to calibrate it with a test weight. The force of gravity at the scale factory isn't necessarily the same as the force of gravity at your house. While you might not notice the increased gravity just yet, you'd notice the expansion. After a month, you'd see a lot of cracks opening up in long concrete structures and the failure of elevated roads and old bridges. Most buildings would probably be okay, although those anchored firmly into bedrock might start to behave unpredictably, just what you want in a skyscraper. At this point, astronauts on the ISS would start getting worried. Not only would the ground and atmosphere be rising toward them, but the increased gravity would also cause their orbit to slowly shrink. They'd need to evacuate quickly. They'd have, at most, a few months before the station re-entered the atmosphere and deorbited. T equals 1 year. After a year, gravity would be 5% stronger. You'd probably notice the weight gain, and you'd definitely notice the failure of roads, bridges, power lines, satellites, and undersea cables. Your pendulum clock would now be ahead by 5 days. What about the atmosphere? If the atmosphere isn't growing like the land or water are, air pressure would start dropping. This is due to a combination of factors. As gravity increases, then air gets heavier. But since that air is spread out over a larger area, the overall effect would be decreasing air pressure. On the other hand, if the atmosphere is also expanding, surface air pressure would rise. After years had passed, the top of Mount Everest would no longer be in the death zone. On the other hand, since you'd be heavier and the mountain would be taller, climbing would be more work. T equals 5 years. After 5 years, gravity would be 25% stronger. If you weighed 70 kilograms when the expansion started, you'd weigh 88 kilograms now. Most of our infrastructure would have collapsed. The cause of the collapse would be the expanding ground below them, not the increased gravity. Surprisingly, most skyscrapers would hold up fine under much higher gravity, although I wouldn't trust the elevators. For most of them, the limiting factor isn't weight, but wind. T equals 10 years. After 10 years, gravity would be 50% stronger. In the scenario where the atmosphere isn't expanding, the air would become thin enough to be difficult to breathe, even at sea level. In the other scenario, we'd be okay for a little while longer. T equals 40 years. After 40 years, Earth's surface gravity would have tripled. Over decades, the force of gravity would grow slightly faster than you'd expect, since the material in the Earth would compress under its own weight. The pressure inside planets is roughly proportional to the square of their surface area, so Earth's core would be squeezed tightly. See siegelman.com/text/planets/internalpressure.htm. At this point, even the strongest humans would be able to walk only with great difficulty. Breathing would be difficult. Trees would collapse. Crops wouldn't stand up under their own weight. Virtually every mountainside would see massive landslides as material sought out a shallower angle of repose. Geologic activity would also accelerate. Most of Earth's heat is provided by radioactive decay of minerals in the crust and mantle, and more Earth means more heat. Although some radioactive elements, like uranium, are heavy, they get squeezed out of the lower layers because their atoms don't mesh well with the rock lattices at those depths. Since the volume expands faster than the surface area, the overall heat flowing out per square meter will increase. It's not actually enough to substantially warm the planet. Earth's surface temperature is dominated by the atmosphere and the sun, but it would lead to more volcanoes, more earthquakes, and faster tectonic movement. This would be similar to the situation on Earth billions of years ago, when we had more radioactive material and a hotter mantle. More active plate tectonics might be good for life. Plate tectonics play a key role in stabilizing the Earth's climate, and planets smaller than Earth, like Mars, don't have enough internal heat to sustain long-term geologic activity. A larger planet would allow for more geologic activity, which is why some scientists think that exoplanets slightly larger than Earth, super Earths, could be more friendly to life than Earth-sized ones. T equals 100 years. After 100 years, we'd be experiencing over 6 G's of gravity. Not only would we be unable to move around to find food, but our hearts would be unable to pump blood to our brains. Only small insects and sea animals would be physically able to move around. Perhaps humans could survive in specially built, controlled pressure domes, moving around by keeping most of our bodies submerged in water. Breathing in this situation would be difficult. It's hard to suck in air against the weight of water, which is why snorkels can only work when your lungs are near the surface. Outside of low-pressure domes, the air would become unbreathable for a different reason. At somewhere around 6 atmospheres, even ordinary air becomes toxic. Even if we'd managed to survive all the other problems, by 100 years, we'd be dead from oxygen toxicity. Toxicity aside, breathing dense air is difficult simply because it's heavy. Black hole? When would the Earth eventually become a black hole? It's hard to answer that, because the premise of the question is that the radius is steadily expanding while the density stays the same, whereas in a black hole, the density increases. The dynamics of really huge rocky planets aren't often analyzed, since there's no obvious way that they could form. Anything that large will have enough gravity to gather hydrogen and helium during planet formation and become a gas giant. At some point, our growing Earth would reach the point where adding more mass causes it to contract rather than expand. After this point, it would collapse into something like a sputtering white dwarf or neutron star. And then, if its mass kept increasing, eventually become a black hole. But before it gets that far, T equals 300 years. It's a shame humans wouldn't live this long, because at this point, something really neat would happen. As the Earth grows, the Moon would, like all our satellites, gradually spiral inward. After several centuries, it would be close enough to the swollen Earth that the tidal forces between Earth and the Moon would be stronger than the gravitational forces holding the Moon together. When the Moon passed this boundary, called the Roche limit, it would gradually break apart. Sorry, Moon. And Earth would, for a short time, have rings. Chapter 46, Weightless Arrow. Question. Assuming a zero-gravity environment with an atmosphere identical to Earth's, how long would it take the friction of air to stop an arrow fired from a bow? Would it eventually come to a standstill and hover in midair? Mark Estano. Answer. It's happened to all of us. You're in the belly of a vast space station, and you're trying to shoot someone with a bow and arrow. Compared to a normal physics problem, this scenario is backward. Usually, you consider gravity and neglect air resistance, not the other way around. Also, you don't usually shoot astronauts with a bow and arrow. At least not for an undergraduate degree. As you'd expect, air resistance would slow down an arrow, and eventually it would stop, after flying very, very far. Fortunately, for most of that flight, it wouldn't be much of a danger to anyone. Let's go over what would happen in more detail. Say you fire the arrow at 85 meters per second. That's about twice the speed of a major league fastball and a little below the 100 meters per second of arrows from high-end compound bows. The arrow would slow down quickly. Air resistance is proportional to speed squared, which means that when it's going fast, the arrow would experience a lot of drag. After 10 seconds of flight, the arrow would have traveled 400 meters, and its speed would have dropped from 85 meters per second to 25 meters per second. 25 meters per second is about how fast a normal person could throw an arrow. At that speed, the arrow would be a lot less dangerous. We know from hunters that small differences in arrow speed make big differences in the size of the animal it can kill. A 25-gram arrow moving at 100 meters per second could be used to hunt elk and black bears. At 70 meters per second, it might be too slow to kill a deer, or, in our case, a space deer. Once the arrow leaves that range, it's no longer particularly dangerous, but it's not even close to stopping. After 5 minutes, the arrow would have flown about a mile, and it would have slowed to roughly walking speed. At that speed, it would experience very little drag. It would just cruise along, slowing down very gradually. At this point, it would have gone much farther than any Earth arrow can go. High-end bows can shoot an arrow a distance of a couple hundred meters over flat ground, but the world record for a hand bow and arrow shot is just over a kilometer. This record was set in 1987 by archer Don Brown. Brown set his record by firing slender metal rods from a terrifying contraption that only vaguely resembled a traditional bow. As the minutes stretch into hours and the arrow slows down more and more, the airflow changes. Air has very little viscosity. That is, it's not gooey. That means things flying through the air experience drag because of the momentum of the air they're shoving out of the way, not from cohesion between the air molecules. It's more like pushing your hand through a bathtub full of water than a bathtub full of honey. After a few hours, the arrow would be moving so slowly that it would be barely visible. At this point, assuming the air is relatively still, the air would start acting like honey instead of water. And the arrow would, very gradually, come to a stop. The exact range would depend heavily on the precise design of the arrow. Small differences in an arrow's shape can dramatically change the nature of the airflow over it at low speeds, but at minimum, it would probably fly several kilometers and could conceivably go as far as 5 or 10. Here's the problem. Currently, the only sustained zero-G environment with an Earth-like atmosphere is the International Space Station, and the largest ISS module, KIBO, is only 10 meters long. This means that if you actually performed this experiment, the arrow would fly no more than 10 meters. Then it would either come to a stop or really ruin someone's day. Chapter 47, Sunless Earth. Question: what would happen to the Earth if the sun suddenly switched off? Many, many readers. Answer: this is probably the single most popular submission to What If. Part of why I haven't answered it is that it's been answered already. A Google search for What If the Sun Went Out turns up a lot of excellent articles thoroughly analyzing the situation. However, the rate of submission of this question continues to rise, so I've decided to do my best to answer it. If the sun went out, we won't worry about exactly how it happens. We'll just assume we figured out a way to fast-forward the sun through its evolution so that it becomes a cold, inert sphere. What would the consequences be for us here on Earth? Let's look at a few. Reduced risk of solar flares. In 1859, a massive solar flare and geomagnetic storm hit the Earth. Magnetic storms induce electric currents in wires. Unfortunately for us, by 1859 we had wrapped the Earth in telegraph wires. The storm caused powerful currents in those wires, knocking out communications and, in some cases, causing telegraph equipment to catch fire. Since 1859, we've wrapped the Earth in a lot more wires. If the 1859 storm hit us today, the Department of Homeland Security estimates the economic damage to the U.S. alone would be several trillion dollars, more than every hurricane that has ever hit the U.S. combined. If the sun went out, this threat would be eliminated. Improved satellite service. When a communications satellite passes in front of the sun can drown out the satellite's radio signal, causing an interruption in service. Deactivating the sun would solve this problem. Better astronomy. Without the sun, ground-based observatories would be able to operate around the clock. The cooler air would create less atmospheric noise, which would reduce the load on adaptive optic systems and allow for sharper images. Stable dust. Without sunlight, there would be no pointing Robertson drag, which means we would finally be able to place dust into a stable orbit around the sun without the orbits decaying. I'm not sure whether anyone wants to do that, but you never know. Reduced infrastructure costs. The Department of Transportation estimates that it would cost $20 billion per year over the next 20 years to repair and maintain all U.S. bridges. Most U.S. bridges are over water. Without the sun, we could save money by simply driving on a strip of asphalt laid across the ice. Cheaper trade. Time zones make trade more expensive. It's harder to do business with someone if their office hours don't overlap with yours. If the sun went out, it would eliminate the need for time zones, allowing us to switch to UTC and give a boost to the global economy. Safer children. According to the North Dakota Department of Health, babies younger than 6 months should be kept out of direct sunlight. Without sunlight, our children would be safer. Safer combat pilots. Many people sneeze when exposed to bright sunlight. The reasons for this reflex are unknown, and it may pose a danger to fighter pilots during flight. If the sun went dark, it would mitigate this danger to our pilots. Safer parsnip. Wild parsnip is a surprisingly nasty plant. Its leaves contain chemicals called furocoumarins, which can be absorbed by human skin without causing symptoms at first. However, when the skin is then exposed to sunlight, even days or weeks later, the furocoumarins cause a nasty chemical burn. This is called phytophotodermatitis. A darkened sun would liberate us from the parsnip threat. In conclusion, if the sun went out, we would see a variety of benefits across many areas of our lives. Are there any downsides to this scenario? We would all freeze and die. Rest in peace, humans. 200,000 BCE to 2024, maybe we shouldn't have extinguished the sun. Chapter 48. Updating a printed Wikipedia. Question. If you had a printed version of the whole of, say, the English Wikipedia, how many printers would you need in order to keep up with the changes made to the live version? Maren Kanings. Answer. 6. That's surprisingly few printers. But before you try to create a live updating paper Wikipedia, let's look at what those printers would be doing and how much they'd cost. If a date took you home and you saw a row of working printers set up in his or her living room, what would you think? Printing Wikipedia. People have considered printing out Wikipedia before. One student, Rob Matthews, printed every Wikipedia featured article, creating a book several feet thick. Of course, that's just a small slice of the best of Wikipedia. The entire encyclopedia would be a lot bigger. Wikipedia user Tom PW has set up a tool that calculates the current size of the whole English Wikipedia in printed volumes. It would fill a lot of bookshelves. Keeping up with the edits would be hard. Keeping up. The English Wikipedia currently receives about 125,000 to 150,000 edits per day, or 90 to 100 per minute. We could try to define a way to measure the word count of the average edit, but that's hard, bordering on impossible. Fortunately, we don't need to. We can just estimate that each change is going to require us to print a page somewhere. Many edits will actually change multiple pages, but many other edits are reverts, which would let us put back pages we've already printed. The filing system that would be required for this would be mind-bending. I'm fighting the urge to start trying to design it. One page per edit seems like a reasonable middle ground. For a mix of photos, tables, and text typical of Wikipedia, a good inkjet printer might put out 15 pages per minute. That means you'll need only about 6 printers running at any given time to keep pace with the edits. The paper would stack up quickly. Using Rob Matthews' book as a starting point, I did my own back-of-the-envelope estimate for the size of the current English Wikipedia. Based on the average length of featured articles versus all articles, I came up with an estimate of 300 cubic meters for a printout of the whole thing in plain text form. By comparison, if you were trying to keep up with the edits, you'd print out 300 cubic meters every month. $500,000 per month. 6 printers isn't that many, but they'd be running all the time. And that gets expensive. The electricity to run them would be cheap, a few dollars a day. The paper would be about 1 cent per sheet, which means you'd be spending about $1,000 a day on paper. You'd need to hire people to manage the printers 24/7, but that would actually cost less than the paper. Even the printers themselves wouldn't be too expensive, despite the terrifyingly fast replacement cycle. But the ink cartridges would be a nightmare. Ink. A study by Quality Logic found that for a typical inkjet printer, the real-life cost of ink ran from 5 cents per page for black and white to around 30 cents per page for photos. That means you'd be spending 4 to 5 figures per day on ink cartridges. You definitely want to invest in a laser printer. Otherwise, in just a month or two, this project could end up costing you $500,000. But that's not even the worst part. On January 18, 2012, Wikipedia blacked out all its pages to protest proposed internet freedom limiting laws. If someday Wikipedia decides to go dark again and you want to join the protest, you'll have to get a crate of markers and color every page solid black yourself. I would definitely stick to digital. Chapter 49, Facebook of the Dead. Question: when, if ever, will Facebook contain more profiles of dead people than living ones? Emily Dunham. Answer: either the 2060s or the 2130s. There are not a lot of dead people on Facebook, at the time I wrote this anyway, which was before the bloody robot revolution. The main reasons for this is that Facebook and its users are young. The average Facebook user has gotten older over the last few years, but the site is still used at a much higher rate by the young than by the old. The past. Based on the site's growth rate and the age breakdown of its users over time, you can get user counts for each age group from Facebook's Create an Ad tool, although you may want to try to account for the fact that Facebook's age limits cause some people to lie about their ages. There are probably 10 to 20 million people who created Facebook profiles who have since died. These people are, at the moment, spread out pretty evenly across the age spectrum. Young people have a much lower death rate than people in their 60s or 70s, but they make up a substantial share of the dead on Facebook simply because there have been so many of them using it. The future. About 290,000 U.S. Facebook users probably died in 2013. The worldwide total for 2013 is likely several million. Note, in some of these projections, I used U.S. age/usage data extrapolated to the Facebook user base as a whole, because it's easier to find U.S. census and actuarial numbers than to assemble the country by country for the whole Facebook-using world. The U.S. isn't a perfect model of the world, but the basic dynamics, young people's Facebook adoption determines the site's success or failure, while population growth continues for a while and then levels off, will probably hold approximately true. If we assume a rapid Facebook saturation in the developing world, which currently has a faster growing and younger population, it shifts many of the landmarks by a handful of years, but doesn't change the overall picture as much as you might expect. In just 7 years, this death rate will double, and in 7 more years, it will double again. Even if Facebook closes registration tomorrow, the number of deaths per year will continue to grow for many decades as the generation who was in college between 2000 and 2020 grows old. The deciding factor in when the dead will outnumber the living is whether Facebook adds new living users, ideally young ones, fast enough to outrun this tide of death for a while. Facebook 2100. This brings us to the question of Facebook's future. We don't have enough experience with social networks to say with any kind of certainty how long Facebook will last. Most websites have flared up and then gradually declined in popularity, so it's reasonable to assume Facebook will follow that pattern. I'm assuming in these cases that no data is ever deleted. So far, that's been a reasonable assumption. If you've made a Facebook profile, that data probably still exists, and most people who stop using a service don't bother to delete their profiles. If that behavior changes, or if Facebook performs a mass purging of its archives, the balance could change rapidly and unpredictably. In that scenario, where Facebook starts losing market share later this decade and never recovers, Facebook's crossover date, the date when the dead outnumber the living, will come sometime around 2065. But maybe it won't. Maybe it will take on a role like the TCP protocol, where it becomes a piece of infrastructure on which other things are built and has the inertia of consensus. If Facebook is with us for generations, then the crossover date could be as late as the mid-2100s. That seems unlikely. Nothing lasts forever, and rapid change has been the norm for anything built on computer technology. The ground is littered with the bones of websites and technologies that seemed like permanent institutions 10 years ago. It's possible the reality could be somewhere in between. Of course, if there's a sudden rapid increase in the death rate of Facebook users, possibly one that includes humans in general, the crossover could happen tomorrow. We'll just have to wait and find out. The fate of our accounts. Facebook can afford to keep all our pages and data indefinitely. Living users will always generate more data than dead ones, I hope. And the accounts for active users are the ones that will need to be easily accessible. Even if accounts for dead or inactive people make up a majority of their users, it will probably never add up to a large part of its overall infrastructure budget. More important will be our decisions. What do we want for those pages? Unless we demand that Facebook deletes them, they will presumably, by default, keep copies of everything forever. Even if they don't, other data vacuuming organizations will. Right now, next of kin can convert a dead person's Facebook profile into a memorial page. But there are a lot of questions surrounding passwords and access to private data that we haven't yet developed social norms for. Should accounts remain accessible? What should be made private? Should next of kin have the right to access email? Should memorial pages have comments? How do we handle trolling and vandalism? Should people be allowed to interact with dead user accounts? What lists of friends should they show up on? These are issues that we're currently in the process of sorting out by trial and error. Death has always been a big, difficult, and emotionally charged subject, and every society finds different ways to handle it. The basic pieces that make up a human life don't change. We've always eaten, learned, grown, fallen in love, fought, and died. In every place, culture, and technological landscape, we develop a different set of behaviors around these same activities. Like every group that came before us, we're learning how to play those same games on our particular playing field. We're developing, through sometimes messy trial and error, a new set of social norms for dating, arguing, learning, and growing on the internet. Sooner or later, we'll figure out how to mourn. Chapter 50. Sunset on the British Empire. Question. When, if ever, did the sun finally set on the British Empire? Kurt Amundsen. Answer. It hasn't, yet. But only because of a few dozen people living in an area smaller than Disney World. The world's largest empire. The British Empire spanned the globe. This led to the saying that the sun never set on it, since it was always daytime somewhere in the empire. It's hard to figure out exactly when this long daylight began, The whole process of claiming a colony on land already occupied by other people is awfully arbitrary in the first place. Essentially, the British built their empire by sailing around and sticking flags on random beaches. This makes it hard to decide when a particular spot in the country was officially added to the empire. The exact day when the sun stopped setting on the empire was probably sometime in the late 1700s or early 1800s when the first Australian territories were added. The empire largely disintegrated in the early 20th century, but, surprisingly, the sun hasn't technically started setting on it again. 14 territories. Britain has 14 overseas territories, the direct remnants of the British Empire. Many newly independent British colonies joined the Commonwealth of Nations. Some of them, like Canada and Australia, have Queen Elizabeth as their official monarch. However, they are independent states that happen to have the same queen. They are not part of any empire that they know of. The sun never sets on all 14 British territories at once, or even 13 if you don't count the British Antarctic territory. However, if the UK loses one tiny territory, it will experience its first empire-wide sunset in over two centuries. Every night, around midnight GMT, the sun sets on the Cayman Islands and doesn't rise over the British Indian Ocean territory until after 1 a.m. For that hour, the little Pitcairn Islands in the South Pacific are the only British territory in the sun. The Pitcairn Islands have a population of a few dozen people, the descendants of the mutineers from the HMS Bounty. The islands became notorious in 2004 when a third of the adult male population, including the mayor, were convicted of child sexual abuse. As awful as the islands may be, they remain part of the British Empire, and unless they're kicked out, the two-century-long British daylight will continue. Will it last forever? Well, maybe. In April of 2432, the island will experience its first total solar eclipse since the mutineers arrived. Luckily for the Empire, the eclipse happens at a time when the sun is over the Cayman Islands in the Caribbean. Those areas won't see a total eclipse. The sun will even still be shining in London. In fact, no total eclipse for the next 1,000 years will pass over the Pitcairn Islands at the right time of day to end the streak. If the UK keeps its current territories and borders, it can stretch out the daylight for a long, long time. But not forever. Eventually, many millennia in the future, an eclipse will come for the island, and the sun will finally set on the British Empire. Chapter 51, Stirring Tea. Question. I was absentmindedly stirring a cup of hot tea when I got to thinking, aren't I actually adding kinetic energy into this cup? I know that stirring does help to cool down the tea, but what if I were to stir it faster? Would I be able to boil a cup of water by stirring? Will Evans. Answer, no. The basic idea makes sense. Temperature is just kinetic energy. When you stir tea, you're adding kinetic energy to it, and that energy goes somewhere. Since the tea doesn't do anything dramatic, like rise into the air or emit light, the energy must be turning to heat. The reason you don't notice the heat is that you're not adding very much of it. It takes a huge amount of energy to heat water. By volume, it has a greater heat capacity than any other common substance. Hydrogen and helium have a higher heat capacity by mass, but they're diffuse gases. The only other common substance with a higher heat capacity by mass is ammonia. All three of these lose to water when measured by volume. If you want to heat water from room temperature to nearly boiling in 2 minutes, you'll need a lot of power. Note, pushing almost boiling water to boiling takes a large burst of extra energy on top of what's required to heat it to the boiling point. This is called the enthalpy of vaporization. 1 cup times water heat capacity times 100 degrees Celsius minus 20 degrees Celsius divided by 2 minutes equals 700 watts. Our formula tells us that if we want to make a cup of hot water in 2 minutes, we'll need a 700-watt power source. A typical microwave uses 700 to 1100 watts, and it takes about 2 minutes to heat a mug of water to make tea. It's nice when things work out. If they didn't, we'd just blame inefficiency or vortices. Microwaving a cup of water for 2 minutes at 700 watts delivers an awful lot of energy to the water. When water falls from the top of Niagara Falls, it gains kinetic energy, which is converted to heat at the bottom. But even after falling that great distance, the water heats up by only a fraction of a degree. Height of Niagara Falls times acceleration of gravity divided by specific heat of water equals 0.12 degrees Celsius. To boil a cup of water, you'd have to drop it from higher than the top of the atmosphere. How does stirring compare to microwaving? Based on figures from Industrial Mixer Engineering reports, I estimate that vigorously stirring a cup of tea adds heat at a rate of about a 10 millionth of a watt. That's completely negligible. The physical effect of stirring is actually a little complicated. In some situations, mixing liquids can actually help keep them warm. Hot water rises, and when a body of water is large and still enough, like the ocean, a warm layer forms on the surface. This warm layer radiates heat much more quickly than a cold layer would. If you disrupt this hot layer by mixing the water, the rate of heat loss decreases. This is why hurricanes tend to lose strength if they stop moving forward. Their waves churn up cold water from the depths, cutting them off from the thin layer of hot surface water that was their main source of energy. Most of the heat is carried away from teacups by the air convecting over them, and so they cool from the top down. Stirring brings fresh hot water from the depths so it can help this process. But there are other things going on. Stirring disturbs the air, and it heats the walls of the mug. It's hard to be sure what's really going on without data. Fortunately, we have the internet. Stack Exchange user D. Rhodes measured the rate of teacup cooling from stirring versus not stirring versus repeatedly dipping a spoon into the cup versus lifting it. Helpfully, D. Rhodes posted both high-resolution graphs and the raw data itself, which is more than you can say for a lot of journal articles. The conclusion? It doesn't really matter whether you stir, dip, or do nothing. The tea cools at about the same rate, although dipping the spoon in and out of the tea cooled it slightly faster. Which brings us back to the original question. Could you boil tea if you just stirred it hard enough? No. The first problem is power. The amount of power in question, 700 watts, is about a horsepower. So, if you want to boil tea in 2 minutes, you'll need at least one horse to stir it hard enough. You can reduce the power requirement by heating the tea over a longer period of time, but if you reduce it too far, the tea will be cooling as fast as you're heating it. Even if you could churn the spoon hard enough, tens of thousands of stirs per second, the fluid dynamics would get in the way. At those high speeds, the tea would cavitate. A vacuum would form along the path of the spoon, and stirring would become ineffective. Some blenders, which are enclosed, actually do manage to warm their contents this way. But what kind of person makes tea in a blender? And if you stir hard enough that your tea cavitates, its surface area will increase very rapidly, and it will cool to room temperature in seconds. No matter how hard you stir your tea, it's not going to get any warmer. Chapter 52, All the Lightning. Question. If all the lightning strikes happening in the world on any given day all happened in the same place at once, what would happen to that place? Trevor Jones. Answer. They say lightning never strikes in the same place twice. They are wrong. From an evolutionary perspective, it's a little surprising that this saying has survived. You'd think that people who believed it would have been gradually filtered out of the living population. People often wonder whether we could harvest electrical power from lightning. On the face of it, it makes sense. After all, lightning is electricity. Citation, the presentation I gave to my third grade class at Assawampset Elementary School while wearing a Ben Franklin costume. And there is indeed a substantial amount of power in a lightning strike. The problem is, it's hard to get lightning to strike where you want it. And I hear it never strikes in the same place twice. A typical lightning strike delivers enough energy to power a residential house for about 2 days. That means that even the Empire State Building, which is struck by lightning about 100 times a year, wouldn't be able to keep a house running on lightning power alone. Even in regions of the world with a lot of lightning, such as Florida and the Eastern Congo, the power delivered to the ground by sunlight outweighs the power delivered by lightning by a factor of a million.